Our final oral argument this morning is the State of Minnesota versus Junting Hay. Good morning. I guess my only question is, before we get started, Mr. Case, thank you. And you'll be arguing it?
I'll be arguing, Your Honor.
Thank you. All right, then, as all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Respondent will have 15 minutes for their argument, and then finally, the state will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So whenever counsel for the state is ready, just approach the microphone, adjust the podium to your level, and please begin by telling us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Robert Yount, appearing on behalf of the state of Minnesota as the appellant in the matter. The post-conviction court below erred when it granted respondent's motion to withdraw his plea. And this court should reverse that decision because under the correct legal standard, as enunciated in Padilla and as applied in Sanchez, the facts on this record amply show and clearly show that he received an adequate Padilla warning before entering his plea and constitutionally adequate representation from his attorney, Mr. Ryan Gary. As to the first part, about the correct legal standard that's at play, the Supreme Court in Padilla established a two-tiered system that distinguishes between the constitutional obligations that criminal defense attorneys have when advising non-citizen clients to enter a guilty plea. The first tier is the most stringent one, and that is triggered when we are talking about a criminal conviction that it is clear, succinct, and straightforward that it is a deportable offense under federal law.
Mr. In Young, situations, can I inquire, is there a potential under the law that there can be a manifest injustice such that a plea may be vacated without necessarily satisfying the Strickland standard?
No, Your Honor.
And why is that?
Well, for a number of reasons. First of all, the entire reason that the Padilla case law and its progeny exist is because the mere consequence of ICE commencing deportation proceedings, that's not manifest injustice. If I were to put that a little bit differently, the fact of the matter is that immigration consequences, that's a consequence of entering a plea of guilty if you're a non-citizen. And that's just a matter of life. It's different in degree and of punitive nature, but it's similar to any other collateral consequence that stems from entering a plea of guilty.
The reason I inquire here is that, and the court made two different fairly thoughtful decisions going through the law that you're talking about and all the law on manifest injustice, and indicated, and so perhaps you don't disagree, that the record was clear that this very carefully created Alford plea to the amended offense following a no jury decision. So obviously we got factual disputes. I suspect a part of why there's an Alford plea to 170 some days, as I recall, and et cetera, to satisfy immigration for the purpose of not being deported. And hence, within weeks, nevertheless, deportation proceedings. So the question I'm getting at is, the phrase manifest injustice, it seemed like everybody was agreeing we were trying to create a plea agreement that would avoid deportation.
Yes, Your Honor, and the state...
Wouldn't that distinguish it from your standard Padilla scenario, where it's just a question literally of ineffective assistance of counsel and whether there was a general versus a direct advice by the counsel? And so that's why that was kind of a premise to my question, is that put this in a different
sure.
category, because they're not alleging directly, at least ineffective assistance of counsel. It's kind of perhaps in a roundabout way, but it wasn't even clear to me necessarily the court was finding ineffective assistance, but under this particular scenario where everybody wanted to avoid deportation,
sure.
everybody, because it sounded like the state was a part of this, nevertheless, that's the result.
There's a lot to unpack there. Can I respond? Yes. Just kind of start at the beginning, and then I will specifically address that. So criminal defendants do not have an absolute right to withdraw their pleas. There has to be a finding of manifest injustice, as Your Honor pointed out. Now, if a guilty plea is not valid, if it's constitutionally invalid, that's manifest injustice. The commencement of ICE proceedings or deportation proceedings, just that alone, that is not manifest injustice, because that is just a consequence of entering a plea of guilty. And so what courts have established under Padilla and Sanchez and the other cases cited is that you need to prove that that plea was entered non-intelligently, that the criminal defendant did not know that immigration consequences were a consequence of entering that plea. Because as you said, it's a bargain, right? When you enter a plea bargain, there are specific terms that you're entering and that you are agreeing to when you enter that. The state is doing the same thing. And so the legal analysis under this does fall under Padilla. And the reason why I was distinguishing between those clear instances is because what this falls into is it falls into a not clear instance. And Padilla recognized that, and Sanchez specifically held that here in Minnesota, is that there are certain crimes, oftentimes under the state law, because you know, there's 50 states and one federal government, there's a disjunction between the two of them. But it's unclear whether that specific crime charged or that you're pleading to is going to qualify as a deportable offense. Rather, to put it differently, it's possible that there may be immigration consequences by pleading guilty to that offense. And that's the legal standard. And that's why we require our criminal defense attorneys to advise under Padilla that there may be deportation consequences, because it's not clear. A criminal defense attorney, Ryan Gary, in this situation, I believe it's uncontested because there's not any briefing or argument to the contrary, there's no way that he could have known, divined from the morass of immigration law, with 100% certainty whether it was or was not a deportable offense. Rather, what is, I believe, unequivocal and not contested is that it was possible that he was picked up for deportation. That, of course, is exactly what happened. And so when Your Honor asks, you know, if he is picked up for deportation, isn't that manifest injustice? No. In fact, that's proof that he received adequate counsel and representation. Now, are there any challenges that he can bring in the immigration context to whether they were wrong? You know, is this not a criminal charge that meets the statutory definition under DHS opinions or standards? Yes, but that's an argument he can make to immigration court. That does not allow him to withdraw his guilty plea under the manifest injustice standard.
Am I correct, though? The record demonstrates that the state, everybody was creating this plea agreement
right,
based on, and maybe another way to say it is, apparently the immigration lawyer gave some assurances that you would not be deported if these boxes are checked in the way that it was. At least that's how the judge seemed to have concluded from all the facts. So I'm assuming in this scenario, for instance, if the state said, yeah, while it's not an obligatory vacating, we're going to support that because we were entering into it, would that have been one just result as well?
No, and I understand. I would offer in response to that, Mr. Hees, the respondent's own statement in his affidavit in support of his motion withdrawal. I think he categorized it perfectly. He said that I wanted to limit the risk to my immigration status. He wanted to limit his risk. He did not have assurances. There's nothing in the record, I should say, that he had affirmative assurances that by entering this plea of guilty, there was zero chance that he would be picked up by ICE or go through deportation proceedings. That's simply not in the record. And that's actually why we're here. Now, that's respondent's argument this entire time, is that he entered this knowing that this would get him out of any deportation risk. That's not supported by the record. For instance, the fact that his attorney felt the need to put a Padilla warning into his petition to enter a plea of guilty shows that immigration consequences were on the mind. They were trying to navigate through them and to give him the best possible chance at that stage if ICE did pick him up or if deportations were started. But that's all that you can do in this situation. Because we have to remember, as the court in Padilla, noted, and specifically the Alito concurrence just takes to task, immigration law is murky. It's unclear. It's shifting. It shifts every time there's a new administration. It shifts every time there's a new attorney general. And so what that means is you have federal courts that are dealing with unclear, not well-established definitions about what is a deportable offense. And so you have state courts here, and all that we require and what the Constitution requires criminal defense attorneys to do is to look at that, to affirmatively take steps, to look at that morass of immigration law and say, is this clearly a deportable offense? If it's not, is there a chance it's a deportable offense? If that's the case, they have an affirmative obligation to advise their client there's a chance by taking this guilty plea and avoiding trial that you could be picked up for deportation. This is the best I can do for you. That's exactly what we have here. That's what we want our criminal defense attorneys to do. And so it's interesting because, you know, obviously I'm here as an appellant defending what a private criminal defense attorney did, but he did exactly what the law requires him to do, and in fact, he went above and beyond that. He conferred with outside immigration counsel. The specific language or communications of those conferences aren't in the record because the privilege was never waived or he was never subpoenaed or in camera review. But it goes to show, as the cases cited in appellant's brief say, that when you consult with immigration counsel, when you consult with your criminal defense attorney, that gives a presupposition that you're entering into that intelligently and that it's a valid plea. And so as to just the points in the record that show that he received constitutionally adequate representation, first and foremost, his petition to enter the plea of guilty contains that specific language that his attorney, Ryan Gary, put in there. As he stated in the motion to withdraw evidentiary hearing, that he added that in particular and specifically added the term deportation so that his client would know that that was a possible consequence. And so you have, in the record, and testified to by respondent himself, he says, quote, "I am not a citizen of the United States. My plea of guilty to this crime may result in deportation." Now, I anticipate they're going to come up here and argue that he didn't know that deportation was a consequence under the terms of the plea. But the record flatly disagrees with that, and that's belied by the record. He acknowledged under oath that deportation was a possible consequence of entering the plea. Now, as Your Honor pointed out, they did everything in their power to avoid the risk, to diminish the risk, to try to navigate through possible waivers, as they talk about. And that's great. But the fact of the matter is that it's still an ever-present chance that he could be picked up for deportation. And that's not manifest injustice. In addition to that, you have Ryan Gary's testimony and respondent's testimony at the hearing talking about how, you know, acknowledging that his outside immigration counsel specifically advised you fully on the consequences of the plea. He agreed with that. There was no question in his mind about what the consequences of the plea were at the time that he entered it. And then you have the court even acknowledging on the record that we're attempting to work with the immigration issues here. At no point in any of the record does anyone say there is no risk that you could go to or you could be deported for this. That's just not in the record. That's what they're trying to advocate for and trying to argue here, but that's not in the record, and that's why we're on appeal asking for a reversal.
Mr. Yount, would this be a different case if some point during the colloquy the petitioner said at the end of it, when everyone is just about to sort of, you know, wrap it up, said, "Now I'm not going to be deported, right?" And someone said, "Right." Would that be different?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay.
To your point, that's not on this record. This record shows that we have a criminal defendant who's a non-citizen who knows that deportation is a possible consequence of entering his plea. That's part of the bargain of entering this plea. They did everything in his power to put him into a waiver program, to kick it over into a gross misdemeanor rather than a felony, a fifth degree rather than a third degree. You have all these steps that they're taking, and that's just good attorneying, good lawyering, quite frankly. But that risk is still there, and you can't completely eliminate it. And so that's why this is such a dangerous holding to adopt their rule of law that they're asking for, because there has never been any case that has recognized that the mere fact that ICE or deportation proceedings have been commenced, that alone is manifest injustice. You rather have to compare that under the Strickland standard as enunciated under Padilla and Sanchez. And I would just finally point to it is an unpublished decision, but it is directly on point and it's recent. And that's the decision of the Tindy decision out of this court in 2017. And it's illustrative because in there you have a criminal defense attorney who's literally walking to the courthouse with her client, and her client asks her, "Could I be deported for this?" And she says, "I don't know, I'm not an immigration attorney." The Court of Appeals nevertheless affirmed that he received adequate representation of counsel because it was unclear whether his crime would result in that. And so you have courts who are very, by definition under Strickland, deferential to the legal profession, to the legal judgments that they are tasked with giving to their clients. And when it really is unclear when looking to the federal statutes outlining immigration, if it really is unclear, all that we can ask of our criminal defense attorneys at that point is to advise of that, saying, look, I'm giving you the best shot that I can come up with under state law, but there is still a chance that there is a risk of deportation proceedings. That's stripped away of politics or leanings. That's the world that we live in. And so that's exactly what Ryan Gary did here. That was constitutionally adequate, and there was no manifest injustice to justify withdrawal of the plea. And so unless the court has any further questions at this time.
No, thank you. Thank you very much.
Leave the remainder of my argument for rebuttal.
We'll now hear for counsel for the respondent, please.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Ryan Case. I'm the defense attorney for Xianting He. And as the court can probably guess, we do believe there was a manifest injustice, and we are asking the court to affirm the order of the Honorable Thomas Fitzpatrick. It's very difficult with such a narrow issue to understand the complex and myriad of things that were going on, not only with a trial where there was a mistrial, not only with new counsel, and then eventually two hearings as to whether my client actually clearly understood what was going on and the real possibility of deportation. In this particular case, and as in all cases when you have a plea bargain is nothing more than a contract. It's a contract between the state and an individual. And they're both going in there with understanding of what that contract means. In this particular case, my client entered into a contract with the state of Minnesota believing that he had there was going to be no deportation. That's what he was told. That's what he understood. Now, be very candid here. My client, throwing in the fact that this is a Chinese national, an immigrant to the United States, who speaks no English, my client obviously was confused. Obviously he's having things thrown at him. The only reason he agreed to this plea was the understanding that he would not be deported. What other reason is there for him to agree to this plea? He had already been through a 6-day trial with a mistrial. He was preparing to go to trial again. The only thing he was worried about was being deported. And clearly, he entered into this agreement because he believed it would prevent deportation. Now, I want to be very clear with that. As it relates to Padilla, yes, there's generally what we say is there for criminal defense attorneys, and I do this all the time. We have to. There's the general and the specific warning. And they're pretty common. If you're convicted of rape, if you're convicted of first-degree murder, you're going to be deported, no question. And yes, there is those cases where you don't know. In this, but however, we have a kind of a higher duty, a higher standard when a defendant is entering into an agreement specifically to avoid deportation. Jail wasn't an issue here. What he was doing this for was deportation. Now, to be fair, my client also was not aware of the sexual predator registration. He didn't know it. He didn't understand it. Clearly, he said after the fact that he did not understand it. And I do believe he did not understand it. These are things that, again, communication with a defendant who English is not their native language is extremely difficult, especially in our court systems. It is not unusual or unbelievable that the defendant could believe one thing, know one thing, but because of language barriers and other things, that might not be the actual what's happening. It happens all the time. Various dialects. We have interpreters in the criminal justice system. Some are really good. Some are not so good. My co-counsel is also a certified interpreter, one of the best. But we sit in courtrooms all the time together, and it's amazing how many times, and I represent a lot of Chinese American clients, just getting to testimony is very, very difficult because they don't understand.
Mr. Case, yes. Is it safe to say, as Mr. Young pointed out, there's nowhere in the record to indicate a specific promise that if I enter this agreement, I will not be deported?
Correct, Your Honor, but there's also nowhere in the record the opposite. Nowhere in the record does it
say. Let me follow that up. I anticipate you might say that. The state's point is that you don't need to say the opposite. One of the things that they point out to, and would you agree with this, the court seemed to hone in on the word deportation not being in the record. Would you agree that Padilla does not require the use of the word deportation to satisfy the Padilla warning, perhaps whether either direct or the vagary area that we have here, the general warning. So the standard we see in Rule 15 petition just says consequences, as I recall. Potential immigration consequences might satisfy the Padilla and the obligation of the defense attorney.
On a general basis, I would agree with the court. However, this was a very unique case. As the court, as the district court correctly determined, the entire basis for the plea was to avoid deportation. Everything was set up to avoid deportation. That was it. And so because of those circumstances, I think the word deportation, if there was a potential for a consequence of deportation, that should have been put on the record, and it wasn't. Now, I will say it was in the plea petition. But again, we get back to, you know, a plea petition, which is supposed to be read by an attorney in with the client. We're told as attorneys we're supposed to do this. Sometimes we do. Sometimes we go through it quickly, depending on the case.
The plea petition in English or Chinese?
English. Okay. English. It had to be read to my client by an interpreter. So, again, then you have that another third party trying to interpret U.S. language into what my client would be able to understand. And again, my client made this bargain. He entered into this agreement with the specific understanding that he wasn't going to be deported.
So do you believe, you must have a different answer than Mr. Yount, then can one comply with the Padilla standard, but still the record and facts support a manifest injustice?
Actually, I absolutely disagree with that. And I want to take
the... Disagree with that? You disagree with the state's answer to that? Or you?
I disagree with the state's answer to that. Yes, and this is one of those cases. Now, there's certain cases that the courts have found you can have a manifest injustice with the consequences that would not be there in another consequence. For example, the Minnesota Court of Appeals in the Sames case, I believe, said that loss of possession of a firearm was not a manifest injustice. They didn't equate that to Padilla. But when you're talking about where your location being deported from the United States, I think that is a higher, it's something that is a higher manifest injustice than a simple loss of possession of a firearm for a specified period of time. And I think the courts recognized that deportation in and of itself, because it's such a serious consequence, that you can comply with the requirements of Padilla, but it could still be a manifest injustice if, in fact, the reason why the defendant pled guilty, entered into this bargain, was solely to avoid immigration consequences. Now, candidly, had the court went on the record, as Justice Conley alluded to, the court said, if my client had said on the record, I'm not going to be deported, and someone would have said, we don't know. We don't know if my client would have continued to plead guilty. Most likely, based upon the plea petition and the record that we have, my client would not have pled guilty. But we don't know that. That's speculation. What we do know is that this entire plea proceeding, everything about it was designed to not get my client deported.
You know, Mr. Case, there's no doubt in my mind your client wanted the agreement structured so that he would not be deported. I believe you. I believe him. The problem is, if we were to affirm this decision, you know, we would have to write an opinion that said, you know, it's manifest injustice to not permit a petitioner to withdraw his plea for immigration consequences if he truly believed that this agreement was going to make sure he wasn't deported, even though the plea petition indicates he might be deported, and even though the law indicates that pleading guilty to crimsex fifth degree is not automatically deportable. My concern would be, although that would certainly, you know, perhaps be justice for your client, that is opening a door that, you know, would be problematic, I think, because we're saying, well, it doesn't matter what the law says, it doesn't matter if you were kind of briefed on it. If you in your heart of hearts would not have done this, even though you got these waivers, mm-hmm. or you know, this information, that's all that matters. I'm pretty sure our case law says the opposite. Well, it doesn't really matter what you truly believed. It matters what's in the record.
Agreed, and that's where we get to the issue, Your Honor. It's not in the record.
I think part of his reason is that the immigration attorney didn't testify. I mean, this would be a different case if he said, you know, when I had my private discussions with your client, I told him you're never going to be deported. Then I think you'd have grounds to get this kicked, as it was kicked.
I agree, Your Honor.
He said, I'm not saying anything or something like that, right?
No, that's, Your Honor, there's some other issues that, again, when you narrow down for the Court of Appeals, you miss some of the other. It was the Ryan Gary who was subpoenaed. The immigration attorney was never subpoenaed.
Okay.
And Ryan Gary was subpoenaed for the motion for reconsideration. At that point, my client did not waive his attorney-client privilege. But
we've got no attorney saying what would be helpful, which is, you know what, I told him, pay no attention to what anything's going on. Doesn't matter what's in the plea petition. It doesn't matter what the judge asks you. You're not going to be deported. I mean, we don't have anything like that, do we?
No, Your Honor, but again, this gets back to kind of the nuances and the...
Go right ahead. I want to
if the court, the first motion for reconsideration, excuse me, the first motion to withdraw was actually handled by my co-counsel, my co-counsel. At that point, there was really no witnesses called. My co-counsel brought a motion. The judge looked at the record, and the record clearly shows my client was not advised that this could be a possible deportation. And then the judge correctly, in my opinion, allowed the motion to withdraw to proceed. We then had a motion for reconsideration, which the court is well aware is a judicially created device. There's nothing in statute. At that motion, the state subpoenaed Ryan Gary. They did not subpoena the immigration attorney. They did not subpoena anybody else. The question at that motion hearing was, who had the burden? We were told, and I don't think, again, this is outside of the record, Judge Fitzpatrick in chambers told counsel, myself, Melissa Satterbeck, who's now Judge Satterbeck, that because this is a motion for reconsideration, the state has the burden. In other words, the state has to prove that the previous order was incorrect. The state has the burden. Once that was communicated to me as trial counsel, it would have been ineffective assistance on my part not to advise my client, don't waive your attorney-client privilege. It would be foolish for me, because at that point, the state has the burden. So that's the reason there was no testimony. Had the state wanted testimony from either of these two attorneys, that should have been at the first hearing, where my co-counsel was lead counsel. At that point, again, attorney strategy, you don't know what you would have done when you're in the heat of a courtroom, but at that point, it's more likely that a defendant would waive the attorney-client privilege because they have the burden to overcome for a motion to withdraw the guilty plea. At the second hearing, our belief was the motion, or the burden was on the state. Now, interestingly enough, Judge Fitzpatrick, in his order, changed that and said the state is correct. The defense does have the burden. However, they met their burden. So we didn't brief that issue because, according to Judge Fitzpatrick, which I do agree with, we met that burden. I just disagree on who has the burden. So that's why there was no testimony from either the immigration attorney or my client did not waive that attorney-client privilege. It was more strategy, Your Honor, than anything else. I would ask the court to affirm the... Yep, I would ask the court to affirm the decision of Judge Fitzpatrick. Clearly, my client entered into a bargain. The only reason he entered into this bargain, this contract, was to avoid deportation. It's clear by the record, that's what my client believed. It's also clear by the record that had there been a potential consequence of deportation, my client should have been informed of that on the record. There's no further questions than...
Thank you. Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for the state will have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honor. You're welcome. I want to begin by addressing some of the issues that were waived and are not before this court that were raised on opposing counsel's oral argument. The issue of predatory registration, that was briefly addressed below, that is not before the court today. It's been waived. The issue of language barriers, about whether his client really understood what was going on, whether his client adequately read the information, there's been no argument briefed, raised, or presented on appeal. That's waived. And again, this discussion about what was or was not talked about in chambers, that's not in the record. It was not supplemented. That's not on appeal. Those fall beyond the record of this appeal. The sole issue on appeal is looking at the record, as Your Honor, Judge Connolly pointed out, and saying, look, apply our consistent legal standard that's been in place for nearly a decade now following Padilla. Apply it to this record that has a specific plea petition acknowledging that deportation is a possible consequence. Combine that with the fact that he had outside counsel, an immigration counsel advising multiple times. They had multiple teleconferences, despite the fact that the testimony establishes that there was an interpreter with them when they were having those conversations with the immigration attorney. There was an interpreter that went through the plea petition with them before entering the plea. And at the hearings, there was an interpreter. Given this, what appears to be a crystal clear record that he received advice that deportation was a possible consequence, should we now allow him to withdraw his plea? There has never been a case that has held that just the mere fact that deportation proceedings are invoked that justifies a plea withdrawal. That's the entire reason why Padilla and Sanchez and that entire body of case law exists, because there has to be a finding that it was invalid, that there was manifest injustice, that it went to his whether knowing, voluntary, or intelligent entry into that contract, as my opposing counsel says. And I do want to briefly talk about the consequences of if this court were to adopt the rule of law that they're asking for here. I believe it's fair to say, yes, you know, in this specific case, I can understand why Mr. He may want to withdraw his plea to avoid immigration consequences. It's fully understandable. That would be a stark departure from every single case that has been interpreting this issue up until here. I have not seen any case cited in respondent's brief that shows that is allowed, and in fact that appears to go against contrary, or it's contrary to every other case that we have in our brief. And if you think about it, it would make, or I should say, holding that their rule of law, it would make a criminal plea for a state crime contingent upon whether ICE or the federal government commences legal proceedings. We don't want our guilty pleas to be contingent. We want them to be final. The law is very clear that it prefers finality, particularly in the context of criminal prosecutions. We're not dealing with just the state. We're also dealing with victims. I mean, keep in mind, we're talking about a criminal sexual conduct charge. The fact of the matter is that when you are charged with CSC as a non-citizen, yeah, that might flag ICE, regardless of whether it's third, fourth, or fifth degree CSC charges. That's what the Sanchez court held with third degree. That's what the Tindy court held with fourth degree, and that's what the Yaka case held with fifth degree. In each circumstance, it was third, fourth, and fifth degree CSC, the courts consistently and cohesively held that there is a chance that deportation might be a consequence for entering a plea to one of those charges. That's exactly what we have here. This appears to be settled law in Minnesota, and granting their rule of law would be a departure from that settled law. Unless the court has any further questions, the state would just ask that this court reverse. And the state takes a position that the record is sufficient to reverse. However, if there is remand, that there would be instruction that the privilege is waived because we are dealing with post-conviction on a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, the matter is submitted. That being our last oral argument of the morning, we are adjourned.